Said people possessing defaced notes should exchange them by the 8th of January. Messages which support opposition leaders and denounce the government have appeared on banknotes since June's disputed election. The Ugandan-born Archbishop of York, John Sentamu, has spoken out against legislation proposed in Uganda that could lead to death sentences for homosexuals. Archbishop Sentamu, the second highest-ranking clergyman in the Church of England, described the proposed law as victimising. He said the Anglican Communion was committed to recognising that gay people were valued by God. President John Atta Mills of Ghana is refusing to accept Christmas presents from well-wishers this year because he says they may be intended to corrupt him. Sending gifts to people in authority is a Christmas tradition in Ghana, but a spokesman for the president said he felt it was better not to accept them as the givers may be seeking something in return. BBC News.
It's 16:06 GMT. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC with Valerie Sanderson. President Obama's aim to overhaul America's healthcare system has moved another step closer. The Senate has approved its final version of a reform bill that could extend medical cover to 30 million people. It's proved a contentious issue from the start, but now, after months of political wrangling and 24 days of debate in the chamber, senators have finally approved their version of the bill with a comfortable majority. Vice President Joe Biden announced the result.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 39, H.R. 3590 as amended, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is passed.
Speaking after the vote, the Democratic Senator Dick Durbin said the bill would give Americans the chance of a better future.
This morning, this vote in the United States Senate lit a candle of hope for 50 million Americans who went to bed last night without the protection of health insurance. For millions who wake this morning wondering if they'll ever win that battle with the health insurance company for the coverage that they need, for the surgical procedure, for the medication. It's also a candle of hope for this nation that we are finally tackling an issue which every family, every business knows is central to our progress as a nation.
But there's still a long way to go before the bill becomes law, as President Obama told a news conference.
Having passed reform bills in both the House and the Senate, we now have to take up the last and most important step and reach an agreement on a final reform bill that I can sign into law. And I look forward to working with members of Congress in both chambers over the coming weeks to do exactly that. With today's vote, we are now incredibly close to making health insurance reform a reality in this country. For the sake of our citizens, our economy, and our future, let's make 2010 the year we finally reform healthcare in the United States.
Our correspondent in Washington, Imtiaz Tab, explains the significance of this latest vote.
This bill isn't going to keep many people happy. Many liberals are disappointed that it doesn't have a robust public option, a public option which would allow American citizens to buy into a government-run plan. Still, this is a huge victory for the Obama administration. Healthcare reform was his top domestic priority. The Senate's bill must still be merged with legislation passed by the House before President Obama can sign a final bill in the new year. Now, there are very significant differences between these two measures. But what we're hearing from the Democrats is that this process has come simply too far for this to fail. Now, both bills do extend health insurance to more than 30 million Americans. But again, this big issue of public option, which is in the House version but not in the Senate version, may prove to be a sticking point. Now, President Obama has promised to be very involved in this process. As we know, he really wasn't involved in this debate in the upper and lower house in getting this bill passed, but the president has pledged to be very much involved in this reconciliation process. Some are saying because he really wants to have this bill signed into law before his State of the Union address, which is going to happen in late January, so that he really has something that he can trumpet about his first year in office.
Imtiaz Taib in Washington. The Yemeni government says it's carried out an operation against al-Qaeda in the east of the country, killing more than 30 militants, including some senior members. The announcement follows a similar operation last week that the authorities said killed 34 militants who were planning attacks on foreign and domestic targets. With more, here's Sebastian Usher from our Arab desk.
No one is in any doubt that al-Qaeda poses a threat in Yemen. But equally, no one knows how big that threat is. It's not clear how many al-Qaeda militants are in the country or how much support they have locally. But in the past decade, the group has carried out many attacks there. The US is certainly deeply concerned. It's put pressure on a sometimes unwilling Yemeni government to take serious action against al-Qaeda. And in the past few days, it clearly has. The authorities say the latest operation hit a high-level al-Qaeda meeting, possibly killing one of the organization's leaders. Last week, a series of raids on al-Qaeda bases and hideouts were said to have killed more than 30 militants. These attacks came as the government continued its months-long offensive against Shia rebels in the north. It's also facing a re-energized separatist movement in the south. In the US, Yemen matters because of fears it might become a new failed state, going the way of Somalia and Afghanistan. But American military support may be counterproductive. Reports on last week's strikes say many civilians were killed. Images of the dead posted on Islamic militant forums are inscribed, "Made in the USA." The risk is that in hitting al-Qaeda hard, the Yemeni government, backed by the US, is likely at the same time to kill civilians, and that could act as al-Qaeda's best recruiting tool.
Sebastian Usher. At least 23 people have been killed in separate bomb attacks in Iraq. The attacks happened in Baghdad and in Hilla, south of Baghdad. A short while ago, I got more details from our reporter in Iraq, Rob Walker.
There were these two different sets of explosions, one in Hilla, which is to the south of Baghdad. There were two explosions there, one of them a car bomb. It was a crowded bus station. There was also an IED. Now, the IED, the improvised explosive device, was in the process of being defused by police when it exploded, killing the head of the bomb disposal team. And then a couple of hours ago, there were more explosions here in Baghdad, one in Sadr City neighbourhood, and the other one, police say, was targeted at Shia pilgrims. And in these two attacks in Baghdad, eight people were killed.
What do you think, Rob, is the significance of the timing of these attacks? Because we're coming up to the climax, aren't we, of the important Shia festival of Ashura?
That's right. Ashura reaches its climax on Sunday in the city of Karbala to the south of Baghdad. The security forces are on high alert in the run-up to that festival because in previous years there have been attacks on Shia pilgrims making their way there. What we understand from the police, the authorities in Hilla, is that this attack there, the car bomb, was not, they say, targeted at Shia pilgrims. But police sources here in Baghdad say one of the bombs here was targeted at Shia pilgrims, and that was an attack which killed three people. So obviously in the next few days, police are going to continue to be on high alert in the run-up to the climax of Ashura.
That was Rob Walker in Baghdad speaking to me a short time ago. You're listening to World Briefing on the BBC World Service. The main news once again, American senators have voted to approve ambitious plans for US healthcare reform, the centrepiece of President Obama's domestic agenda. The Georgian Foreign Ministry says it's reached a deal with Russia to open a border crossing that's been closed for 3 years. The Upper Lars checkpoint is the only land crossing that doesn't go through Georgia's South Ossetia and Abkhazia. The Russian-backed rebel territories were the focus of a brief war between the two countries last year. Our correspondent in Moscow, Rupert Wingfield-Hayes, told me more.
Well, according to the Russian Foreign Ministry, which has just confirmed these reports and said that this agreement is for real, it will be open to Russian, Georgian and Armenian people to cross the border. This is the only border crossing that Russia and Georgia share outside of the breakaway regions that Russia is now in control of inside Georgia. So this is a very important road crossing. It was in the past very important for trade between Georgia and Russia, but perhaps even more importantly for trade between Russia and Armenia, which is a small landlocked country that borders Georgia and is very close to Russia. And for the last 3 years, there hasn't been any land transportation route between Russia and Armenia. So it's kind of crucial for Armenia.
Why do you think agreement has been reached now?
Well, I think Russia would like to see this route to Armenia reopened. The Georgians would clearly like to see a reopening of all links, transportation links with Russia, because Georgia's economy is highly dependent on Russia. There is a lot of Georgian investment in Russia and lots of Georgian people living in Russia. So I think the Georgians are very keen for this to happen. They would like to now see air links also reopened and also want Russia to lift an embargo on the importation of Georgian wines and Georgian mineral water and other Georgian products that have been effectively banned from being imported to Russia for the last 2 years.
Rupert Wingfield-Hayes in Moscow. A senior Anglican cleric in Britain, the Archbishop of York, has spoken out against anti-homosexual laws being debated in Uganda. John Sentamu, who was born in Uganda, said proposals which could see gay people put to death were victimising. Speaking to the BBC, Dr. Sentamu said the Anglican Communion was committed to recognising that gay people were valued by God. This report from James Reid.
Around 40% of Ugandans are Anglicans, so the words of Archbishop Sentamu carry real weight. But the issue of homosexuality has already brought the worldwide Anglican Communion close to schism, with the Church of Uganda leading African opposition to the ordination of gay bishops. So the Archbishop chose his words with care. Referring to a statement agreed by the Communion in 2004, he said Anglicans recognised homosexuals as children of God.
People may have very clear, what I call, traditional views about sexuality, but we as a communion are actually committed to listening to the experience of homosexual people. You can't do that on one hand and then have language which in many ways seems to suggest as though these people are non-children of God. I mean, they are valued by God, they deserve the best we can give in pastoral care and friendship.
Archbishop Sentamu said he regarded the proposed law as victimising and said he was in any case opposed to the death penalty. And he pointed out that existing laws against homosexuality in Uganda already include harsh penalties. He said he had been in touch with his Anglican colleagues in Uganda and expected them to make a statement in due course that reflected the church's duty of pastoral care to gay people.
James Reid. As Christmas Day approaches, thousands of Christian pilgrims have been gathering in the West Bank town of Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus. Our Bethlehem correspondent, Bethany Bell, is in Manger Square.
The ancient Church of the Nativity is full of pilgrims. In a grotto below the church is the site where Christians believe Jesus Christ was born. Tonight, Catholics will be celebrating Midnight Mass here. Orthodox Christmas follows a week later. Outside the church, Palestinians, both Christian and Muslim, are gathering in Manger Square where bands and choirs are performing. For many, being in Bethlehem at Christmas time is a special experience.
It's fascinating to see it for once, you know, and see how many Christians come here together, you know, and how many Palestinians are Christian. It's remarkable to see that, and it's something you won't forget.
Tourism in Bethlehem is gradually reviving, but people here say tourists are put off from visiting because of the high concrete barrier Israel has built around the town. Many of those who do visit come on bus trips and stay just for a few hours. Israel says the barrier is necessary for its security, but Palestinians say it's choking Bethlehem.
Bethany Bell reporting from Bethlehem. Transistors are used in virtually every modern electronic device, from radios to computers, to control or amplify electronic signals. Now, scientists in the United States and South Korea say they've created the first transistor made from a single molecule. Writing in the scientific journal Nature, they found that individual molecules of the chemical compound benzene can have the same properties as larger transistors. Here's our technology correspondent, Mark Gregory.
Transistors are the building blocks of modern electronics. They've been getting smaller ever since the technology was invented 80 or so years ago. Early transistor radios caused a sensation because they were tiny compared to the valve-driven products that preceded them. Today's computer microchips are effectively millions of that sort of transistor packed into a piece of silicon the size of a pinhead. But now researchers at Yale University in the US and a leading technology institute in South Korea have taken electronic miniaturization to a whole new level. They've created a transistor out of a single molecule of the chemical compound benzene. Attached to contacts made of gold, a good conductor of electricity, they found benzene molecules can be manipulated to amplify or control an electrical current, which is exactly what a conventional transistor does. But the scientists say it will be many decades, if ever, before the breakthrough has any kind of commercial application.
Mark Gregory. The main news: American senators have voted to approve ambitious plans for U.S. healthcare reform, the centerpiece of President Obama's domestic agenda. This is World Briefing here on the BBC. Now, the business news, and there's been a nice surprise for the bosses of several companies in the US, which were only kept afloat with taxpayer bailouts. With all the details, here's Alex Ritson. Alex.
Thanks, Val. Yes, the pay czar Ken Feinberg has approved big pay packages for executives at General Motors. Also coming up, Venezuela's leader threatens foreign car firms, telling them to share their knowledge or leave the country. And the manipulative language of the financial crisis, a lighter look from a well-known voice.
Referring to loans as subprime avoided the reality that they were junk, like describing someone on his deathbed as subwell.
I'll tell you who he is shortly. Rightly or wrongly, one element of the financial crisis has caused newspaper headlines day after day. Executive pay. Huge pay packets for, as they're often described, the fat cats who run failing companies. Failing companies which in the United States are now only still in business because of massive bailouts by the taxpayer. To tackle this, President Obama appointed a pay czar to place limits on the pay of executives who took money from the TARP, or Troubled Asset Relief Program. Now, pay czar Ken Feinberg has caused a degree of controversy with the way he's implemented the rules. Our business reporter Mark Gregory has been following the story.
You have to bear in mind what the limits are. Essentially, back in October, the newly appointed pay czar, Kenneth Feinberg, he said that normally companies that had received large bailouts from the US government would not be allowed to pay the top 25 executives in those companies more than $500,000 a year salaries. But now, in essentially his first test, he's actually exceeded those limits with two of the key companies that are covered by the pay rules.
Because he's allowing people who are in companies that were in receipt of bailout money from the federal government to effectively pay themselves whatever they like. Surely that must have gone down very badly in middle America.
Well, certainly there's been a lot of public rage at the high level of executive pay and bonuses, especially in companies that have been bailed out with tens of billions of dollars by the American taxpayer. But in these particular cases, at General Motors, Chris Liddell, the incoming chief financial officer, has been allowed a salary of $750,000, so that goes above the government limit. And over a period of years, he could receive a further $5.5 million in share options, though he's not going to be allowed to exercise these until General Motors, which has come out of bankruptcy, has its IPO, perhaps next year. And there's another senior executive, Michael Carpenter of GMAC, which is the financing arm that provides the financing for Chrysler and General Motors cars. And he's being allowed a base salary of $950,000, so nearly twice the government limit.
But what's the justification for this? Because these are companies which were in receipt of bailout money. Why are they allowed to pay themselves telephone number salaries?
Well, no explanation has actually been given, but the real problem is simply that these companies, of course, have been in a very difficult situation, and to get them out requires some pretty highly qualified people. And the reality is that unless you pay them reasonably large sums of money, you can't get them.
So this is market forces at work?
I suppose it is.
Our business reporter, Mark Gregory. He's already nationalised several industries and has been something of a thorn in the side of foreign companies since he came to power. Now, Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez has told foreign car makers they should share their technology with local businesses or leave the country. With more, here's the BBC's Oliver Woods.
President Chavez gave the ultimatum to Ford, General Motors, Toyota and Fiat during a public ceremony in the Venezuelan capital. There was no immediate response from the companies, which all have assembly plants in the country. Mr. Chavez said that if his demand isn't met, he will ask them to leave Venezuela. Russian and Chinese car makers may be asked in instead. The Venezuelan government has recently nationalised major companies in the metals, cement, oil, coffee and electricity sectors, as it aims to build a socialist economy. Last year, foreign vehicle plants in Venezuela produced over 100,000 cars and trucks. But Venezuela's currency controls have the industry struggling to obtain the cash they need to import enough parts and to pay for debts.
Oliver Woods, to the markets now. London very light in the last session before Christmas, closed up 0.6% at 54.02. New York, the Dow up 0.4%. Euro buys $1.43.6. US cents, the pound trading $1.59.3. In the old days, a loan was known as a loan and a mortgage as a mortgage. That was before the financially futuristic decade of the noughties, with the explosion in derivatives and futures and other complicated-sounding financial instruments. But as the products got increasingly complex, the language to describe them got ever more bizarre. Harry Shearer has written an album of songs based on the language used around the crisis. You might recognise his voice, as he also plays several of the characters in the cartoon series The Simpsons.
The verbal race to the bottom began when banks, insurance companies and financial firms started referring to their services as products, maybe to make their people feel more muscular, less nurturing. This seemingly innocuous change led, as it did in the world of actual products, to product innovation. Enter NINAs, home loans requiring from their prospective borrowers no income, no assets. As with real tangible products, once they were sold, future responsibility for them was farmed out to someone else, preferably in Bangalore. The only service left in the equation was the servicing of the loans, itself a euphemism for collecting. Calling these loans NINAs feminized them, rendered them cute, naughty, but not criminal. Just as referring to loans as subprime avoided the reality that they were junk, like describing someone on his deathbed as subwell. When things started cratering, the language got cuter. A year ago, the main cause of the crisis was supposedly the crushing burden of toxic assets, home mortgages lent to borrowers who could afford to pay them off just as soon as pigs filed flight plans. But when the U.S. Treasury got $750 billion, supposedly to rid the banks of this stuff, the word toxic was replaced by the word troubled. Really, these assets were now like delinquent youth, faces smudged with dirt, clothes tattered, souls still full of potential. They didn't need to be wiped off the books, just understood. Where were those assets supposed to go? Officials proposed a bad bank. Another miscreant, like the dog who poops on the living room carpet. Bad bank. Sit in the corner and think about those stinky mortgages you're collecting. The main thrust of this euphemistic gambit was a brave attempt to convince us that there's such a thing as a good bank. Nice try. Those assets were securitized, which is to securing as believitizing would be to believing. Believitizing actually is the creation of exactly the level of credulity this stuff deserved. Unfortunately, nobody bothered to coin that word until just now. The essence of securitizing was persuading the financial ratings companies, by means unknown, that a collection of slices of garbage mortgages could be a AAA-grade investment, which really was ratingizing. Recently, we've been hearing from the peddlers of positive thinking, among whom green shoots have contended with glimmers of hope as the optimistic usage of choice. Glimmers has been a favorite of U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Visualizing these glimmers became for him almost an evangelical enterprise. Were they an aurora Geithnerialis, or were they signs of a true recovery? Don't ask, brothers and sisters, just believe. And then there's the word tossed around by CEOs and financial journalists alike, designed to anesthetize one of the most painful consequences of economic slowdown. That word is shed, not the little building out back, but what prudent companies do to jobs. We haven't been experiencing the widespread throwing of people out of work, just the shedding of jobs. It makes the process sound all National Geographic, like what snakes do with their skins every whenever. Unfortunately, the word's progress has not yet led it to the actual transaction. Bill, we value your contribution to the company over the years, but we're going to have to shed you. No, let you go is still the standard euphemism, begging the question, but what if I don't want to go? We're still letting you do it. This is Harry Shearer for the BBC World Service.
How about Pazar? And his album, Harry Shearer's album, Greed and Fear, will be available at digital music stores from early next month. He plays all sorts of characters in The Simpsons, Mr. Burns, Waylon Smithers, Ned Flanders, Reverend Timothy Lovejoy, Kent Brockman, Dr. Hibbert, and Lenny Leonard.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International. Distribution is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. More information online at gatesfoundation.org, and by individual donors to PRI, whose contributions help bring innovation and diversity to public radio programming.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Purvina Covenant Medical Center, now an in-network provider for all Health Alliance plans, including HMO, PPO, Point of Service, and Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO. Prevena encourages you to join them in supporting WILL.
BBC, BBC.
You're with the BBC. Coming up on Outlook after the news, 30 years after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, we hear from people who were there, including a mountaineer with a top-secret mission. Also, how Argentina's teenagers are escaping the boredom of rural life to become radio stars, and the dancer who spent 55 years with Britain's Royal Ballet. That's Outlook after the news.
BBC News with Jonathan Wheatley. The United States Senate has voted in favour of one of President Obama's key domestic policies, the extension of health care cover to nearly all Americans. To become law, the bill will now have to be reconciled with one previously passed by the House of Representatives. Speaking after the vote, Mr. Obama said it was the most important piece of US social legislation since the 1930s. The authorities in Yemen say their forces have killed more than 30 al-Qaeda militants in an air raid in the eastern province of Shebwa. Officials said the militants were holding a meeting to plan attacks on Yemeni and foreign oil targets. Bomb attacks in Iraq have killed at least 23 people and wounded many others. Two near-simultaneous explosions at a crowded bus station in Hilla, south of Baghdad, killed at least 15 people and wounded 70. The second bomb detonated as police were trying to defuse it. In Baghdad, at least 8 people were killed by 2 bombs, one in the mainly Shia district of Sadr city and the other targeting Shia pilgrims in the east of the city. Georgia says it has agreed with Russia to reopen their joint land border. The Georgian deputy foreign minister said she expected it to reopen by the beginning of March. It was closed in 2006 amid tensions over Georgia's efforts to build closer ties with the West. The Chinese judicial authorities have imposed the death penalty on another 5 people for their part in bloody ethnic riots earlier this year in the western region of Xinjiang. It brings to at least 22 the number of people sentenced to death in connection with the violence. And President John Atta Mills of Ghana is refusing to accept Christmas presents from well-wishers this year because he says they may be intended to corrupt him. A spokesman for the president said it was better not to accept traditional gifts, such as hampers of food, as the givers might be seeking something in return. BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. On today's programme, 30 years after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, we hear the personal stories of 3 people who were there. Also, the teenagers in Argentina who are escaping the boredom of rural life to become local radio stars. And we meet the 71-year-old who's still dancing with Britain's Royal Ballet after 55 years with the company. First, as we approach the 30th anniversary of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, on today's Outlook we hear the extraordinary stories of 3 people directly involved in the events of the 27th of December 1979. At that time, the Soviets already had a strong presence in Kabul as advisers and military backup to President Hafizullah Amin. But they were unhappy with his dictatorial regime and the growing opposition to him, so the decision was taken to depose him. From December the 25th, 1979, large numbers of Soviet troops were flown into Afghanistan, ostensibly to help President Amin fight the Mujahideen. At the same time, the president moved out of his residence in the centre of Kabul to the newly renovated Tajbek Palace on the outskirts. On the evening of the 27th, Soviet special forces stormed the palace and the president was assassinated. Remembering those events for Outlook are Najiba Zire, who now works for the BBC, and whose father was Minister of Health in President Amin's government. As an 11-year-old, she was with her mother and brother at the palace when it was stormed. Ervant Ilyinsky is a mountaineer from Kazakhstan whose mission was to recover the Soviet invasion plans from a crashed plane. And first we hear Oleg Balashov from the Alpha Group of Soviet Special Forces, who took part in the attack on the palace.
We arrived in Afghanistan on December the 23rd. We landed at Bagram, and the next morning we were taken to Kabul. We were told at the Soviet embassy what our mission was. We were ordered to storm the Tajbek Palace and kill the president.
For 11-year-old Najiba, life carried on as normal. She had no idea what was about to happen. But she says her grandmother had noticed unusual goings-on for several days.
She was a very wise old lady, and she said, "There are so many aeroplanes, and I wonder, you know, what is happening? They wouldn't stop all day since morning." And she remembered the timing of the aeroplanes. Now, at that time, the political situation was that President Hafizullah Amin had Russian advisers around him, but nobody in the government could imagine that the situation will change. Now, President Amin was moved to this new palace called Taj Beg. It's in the outskirts of Kabul. The advice was that for security reasons, the family should move out. And the old palace was renovated and his family was moved out. Later, people said that this was a very clever way by the Russians not to be attacking the palace in the middle of the city, but to be doing this outside somewhere.
It was a magnificent three-story building with walls about a meter thick. There were around 300 soldiers guarding it. There were only 23 of us. We spent the next 3 days familiarizing ourselves with the layout. We had to work out the best approach route and get to know the security guards and all the people who surrounded President Amin. Every night we'd go to the palace in a military vehicle and tell the guards that we were doing special training to ensure even higher security at the palace. It was while we were making these preparations that we saw a plane approaching in the distance, then it crashed. We knew they were our forces, and we guessed everyone must have been killed.
In Almaty, capital of the then Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan, mountaineer Ervand Ilyinsky got an urgent phone call.
The local sports minister called me and said that I had to get a rescue team together for a mission in Tajikistan. I asked him where exactly, what altitude, and he told me to call Moscow. The person I spoke to in Moscow told me that it was a rescue operation at 6,000 meters, and I should get together a team of climbers, but all single men, without families. We arrived at the military airport, and the general who met us told us to give him our passports in exchange for guns. We were surprised by such an unusual order. We were all then issued with a pistol, a portable radio, and a first aid kit. We were in the air, and all of a sudden the pilot announced that we were crossing the border. The pilot told me we were going to Kabul. When we started our descent, we saw hundreds of Soviet military tents on the ground. That's strange, we thought, but we assumed there was some kind of military training going on. Our accommodation was in a military building at the airfield. There, on the same airfield, we saw the Alpha Group. The next morning, we were given better guns and we got onto a helicopter that was meant to take us to the crash site. But it was unable to land at that altitude. And in the end, we had to call on a specialist pilot from Kyrgyzstan.
Ervand and his team spent another night in Kabul while they waited for the replacement pilot. That was when the war started.
They put us in a different building first, but someone said the walls were too thin. It wasn't bulletproof, so they moved us. Then some general said that if people started running down the hallways and shooting, we were to lock ourselves in our rooms. He said if anyone knocked on the door and spoke in Russian without an accent, we could open up. But if they spoke with an accent, we should shoot without opening the door. I said, "But what if we kill someone?" He said, "Well, that's war, isn't it?" That was the first time someone had said the word war, and we finally understood that this wasn't a military exercise. It was something far more serious.
During the day, Najiba and her family, along with other ministers and their families, were all invited to join the president for lunch at the Taj Beg Palace.
Mrs. Amin said to everyone that all the food and everything is tested before it's delivered by the Russian doctors. They want to make sure the nutrition and they want to make sure that it's safe and secure. My mother was 7 months pregnant with my brother at that time. And I remember later my mother remembering and recalling that the Russian doctor, the lady, did not allow her to finish her soup We were giving some sort of a sedative in that soup. But my mother will say that the Russian doctor, she almost took her soup before she finished, before my mother finished it. So it's almost like a, you know, a conflict between your job and also looking at this pregnant, heavily pregnant woman. After the lunch, we all felt tired. You know, without a doubt, everyone knew that something did happen. President Amin called his doctor. And then, just before 7 o'clock, a huge blast, a huge sound happened, which woke me up. And my first reaction was, this is the Mujahideen, because this was our fear at that time. And then I remember also a point where this was established, who are attacking. I remember this word, it's the Russians. And I couldn't understand. I mean, they were the good guys. They were friends. Why would they be attacking?
As Najiba and others in the palace awaited their fate, it was time for Oleg Balashov and his special forces colleagues to carry out their mission.
On December 27th, at about 7 in the evening, we were told that the operation was to start in about half an hour. According to Russian tradition, we drank some vodka. Our spirits were high and we were ready to fight. We got into the vehicles just like we did every evening and drove towards the palace. The security guards at the first checkpoint told us to stop. We didn't, and they started firing at us. We still had about 500 meters to go to the palace under fire. We'd got right to the area in front of the palace when my vehicle was hit. As soon as we got out, we were fired on continuously. Our orders were not to kill everyone in the palace. Only Amin had to be killed. Half of the building was on fire. Cars outside were burning. He knew that we were coming after him.
This Afghan guy who stood with us, he was standing next to the window and almost reporting what was happening outside. And then I heard him saying, "Oh God, I'm shot, I'm shot." And my mother said, "Oh, can you come away? Can you come away from the window?" She asked the guy to hold his hand up and she tied his hand. And we stayed there for, I don't know how long, but it felt really long because I was battling between sleep and this fear that we will be killed.
Once the Alpha group was inside the palace, they went from room to room. Eventually, they found Najiba and her family and brought them downstairs. By then, the president was dead.
I can describe what happened based on what I was told by the soldier who killed him. He went into the room. He saw Amin standing beside a table, unarmed. One shot was enough. Amin didn't cry out or anything.
Two of the president's sons also died that night, and other members of his family were injured.
We came downstairs, and they took us to this room, and I saw President Amin's wife sitting on the floor with her two daughters, two teenage daughters, injured. And her daughter-in-law was there. Her grandson, 4-month baby, was there. Her old mother was there. I think her other son was also there. And she saw my mother, and both of them started crying and hugging. And she said to my mother, "I'm a widow, I'm a widow. Hajira, I'm a widow. They killed my husband, they killed my son." Amin's two sons died that night. One was his oldest son, Abdurrahman, and one was the 12-year-old boy. And she wouldn't stop crying, and she would remember this little, especially the little one. She would say, "Oh, he was bleeding, he was shot in the stomach, he died in front of me." And we sat there for a while. An African tall man came, and he later I knew this was one of the military officers, Sarwari, who is in prison currently in Kabul, and he took part in the Russian coup. He came, he opened the door, and the Russians were behind him, and he said to Amin's wife, "You know, he's dead, we killed him, he deserved this." And her reply will always stay in my mind. She said, "What kind of man are you coming and telling his wife that you killed the husband? Spit on your face." And I just thought, you know, you're sitting on the floor, your family is half dead, and, you know, the courage of that woman, I will never forget.
For Oleg Balashov, the mission had been successfully completed.
I think we carried out our task well. We left Kabul the next day.
As Oleg's task ended, Ervan's began. He too left Kabul, but in a helicopter bound for the Pamir Mountains, where, in the wreckage of a crashed aircraft, lay the Soviet invasion plans.
We jumped out of the helicopter from about 2 or 3 meters, as the snow was too deep for it to land. We could see that the plane had just failed to clear the summit. It had crashed literally 10 or 15 meters from the top. Half of the wreckage was on one side and half on the other. At first, we were told to find the bodies and check any documents on them. But when one of our team found a black briefcase, suddenly the mission was over. I didn't look inside the case. We gave it to the general, and he hugged it, and the operation was finished.
For Najiba, the ordeal continued. She, her mother, and her brother were taken to prison, along with the president's widow, Patmana, and the surviving members of her family. Najiba's family were released after 10 days, but not Mrs. Amin. She spent many years in jail. The almost continuous conflict in Afghanistan since 1979 has taken a heavy toll on both families. And Ervand Ilyinsky wonders what it was all for.
No, we didn't discuss it at the time. Back then, it was all presented as the defense of our country. It's only now that we understand that the whole idea of the invasion was absolutely stupid. But back then, you didn't ask questions.
Ervand Ilyinsky ending those extraordinary first-hand accounts of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan 30 years ago. The reporter on the story was Katya Moskvich. This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Coming later in the programme, what does it take to be a top-class ballet dancer for 55 years? We ask the man who's done just that with Britain's Royal Ballet. But now, Argentina is a vast country with a tiny population. Half of the country's 40 million inhabitants live in the capital, Buenos Aires, leaving the rest scattered in small rural communities. Well, now, the Education Ministry has started a special radio project to break the isolation of those communities. There are 3 stations so far, and they're all run by teenagers. From the province of Chubut, the size of the UK, and far to the south of Patagonia, Candace Piet reports.
In Puerto Piramides, there's not much to do. The village in the arid semi-desert of Patagonia has a population of less than 400 people. In the spring, the tourists come for the whale watching, but the winters are long and cold, and if you're growing up here, life can get a little boring. But things have been changing around here. Backed by the Ministry of Education, there's a new radio in town, playing 24 hours of sports, health, arts and interviews, with lots of music in between. But this is no ordinary radio station. The technicians, the presenters and the reporters are all teenagers. In a tiny cubicle inside the wooden chalet which houses the village's culture secretariat, 16-year-old Eileen Evoe Montero is waiting to go on air. She helps out on the slot for the young children, and she's waiting for children and their parents to arrive to be interviewed.
My life has changed a lot because we have to be organised, be here on time. It's a really big responsibility. We have to work together with other kids.
Thanks to their involvement in the project, many of Eileen's friends have found a new confidence, losing some of their teenage embarrassment. These 2 16-year-olds presenting the football news slot have won a bursary to study sports journalism. Leonel Burgueño says that before all this, he wasn't talkative at all. For others, like Ruben Hernandez, the radio helped bring them back into the fold. Bored with life and school in Puerto Piramides, he dropped out of school and, according to his teachers, was spending too much time in bars.
I love the computer. I'd been making sound projects just for me, but now they say we need a jingle or we need to edit this, so things have really changed. I really want to do this as a career now.
And the radio has got the adults communicating in new ways too. Annie bought herself a radio to listen to while she was doing her ironing. Her daughter is one of the reporters who interview local celebrities when they visit. She told us the local clinic gives health advice on the radio, the firemen, fire safety tips, and the parents are also finding novel ways of using the radio.
The other day, one mother rang into the radio and put a message out to tell her kids supper was on the table. We all listen to the radio now.
Roxana Murdochovic is the driving force behind the school's radio project at the Ministry of Education.
We wanted a program where we challenge the students, and we wanted to show that when they get a challenge that is interest and that improves the quality of life of their community, they organize themselves, they know how to fight for what they consider is positive. The message is this, actually, is adolescents are not only what you see on TV regularly in the news, but also are the future of this country, and we can trust them because when there is something that it's important for them, they go for that.
Candace Piet reporting on Argentina's new community radio stations. Well, now, I've always thought that ballet dancers were pretty much like sports stars. They start young, and if they're lucky, they can count on a few years at the top before their punishing physical schedule takes its toll. But we seem to have found the exception to that rule. David Drew has spent an astonishing 55 years as a dancer with Britain's Royal Ballet. He joined the ballet school in 1954 and the company a year later. Since then, he's worked under seven artistic directors and danced with most of the great stars, including Rudolf Nureyev, Margot Fonteyn and Sylvie Guillem, to name but a few. At the age of 71, David is the oldest principal character artist performing with the ballet today. He's about to take on the role of Lord Capulet in the latest production of Romeo and Juliet. I went to meet him at the Royal Opera House in London while he was rehearsing for that role. So, David, you're rehearsing for the part of Lord Capulet in Romeo and Juliet. How many times have you danced that role?
For about 25 years. I've done most of the male roles in Romeo and Juliet. People say my best role was Tybalt, because I'm very good at being a baddie. And then people unkindly say, oh, it's typecasting, you're like that in real life, Drew, and I suspect they're probably right. Really, I'm roped in to sort of kill people or generally behave rather badly.
191, Paul Duffy, 191.
Somebody calling someone to the stage. Yes. Let's talk a little bit about your career. When did you first start dancing? Were you very young?
I was 8, and my mum had been a dancer and my dad had been a singer. My mum said, to see if you might like to do dancing, we'll go to the Bristol Hippodrome. They've got an act there in the variety show. It was an adagio act. He was very muscular and strong, and she was tiny, and he would partner her and throw her around. And they did that in the first half. But in the second half, she, known as the Pocket Venus, also did artistic posing. The curtain would open, and she would be lying naked on a couch surrounded by various acolytes, and there would be genteel applause from the audience, artistic appreciation, and then the tabs would close, and then it would open, and she'd be in another aesthetic pose. And I found all this rather stimulating. So I thought, So I said to my mum, well, you know, yes, I think I might get quite interested in this dancing business. And she never knew, Paul, up to the day she died, why I really started.
And you had to combine your dancing with your academic studies. Did your mother teach you to dance before you went to school?
Every morning, poor soul, she would give me an hour's class. I hated her for it because she drove me so hard. But she did it for my sake. But I wouldn't have had the career I had it not been for her. And I got a scholarship to Bristol Grammar School. Then after that, came up to London and joined the Royal Ballet School.
Well, you make that sound very easy, but you had to have an audition, didn't you, with the founder of the Royal Ballet, Dame...
Ninette de Valois.
Ninette de Valois.
Indeed.
Tell me about that audition, because you must have been nervous, weren't you?
Very nervous, and it was almost unheard of for Madame to conduct an audition for the school herself. And it was here at the Opera House upstairs. I did about 10 minutes of various exercises and things for her, and she accepted me into the company.
Was that a great moment for you?
It was wonderful. But one has to be honest. Males were in rather short supply in 1954. And frankly, if you'd got two arms, two legs and could more or less keep time, then you were probably going to get into the school.
You're just being modest now, aren't you?
No.
It's an incredibly rigorous career to take on physically, isn't it? I wonder if you could just talk about the routine that you're letting yourself in for when you embark on a career as a ballet dancer.
I mean, now, as we came here, you saw dancers beginning to warm up before they go into their formal class at 10:30. Once the day starts, it just goes on. You break from 5:30 to 7:30 to prepare for the show and grab a bite, perhaps. You know, you never get to sleep before 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and then you've got to get back here again, and you go through the whole routine, and that's it, 6 days a week. And it does take up so much of one's time. The danger is that one becomes too insular. It's very difficult to lead a, quote, normal life.
You travelled all over the world with the ballet. I think you went on tour on a train across America at one point. What was that experience like?
People said that England was well known in America for three things: Rolls-Royce, whiskey, and the Sadler's Wells Ballet, because that's what we were then when I joined. We only became the Royal Ballet a year later, and we toured the rest of America after New York in our own train.
So you had sort of bunks on the train?
We had bunks on the train. Now, you imagine a lot of young, lively, quite attractive, physically well-turned-out people in that sort of situation. We had a lot of fun. How many people can you get into a, what's it, you know, 27, that was a record. You know.
Into one of the bunks.
Oh, yes.
And did you carry out your own scenery with you and the orchestra?
That was the point. The important thing was getting the scenery around. So you arrived in a town, city, get to the theatre somehow, unpack, go on, do your performance, and then you try to find somewhere to eat, and you'd almost inevitably end up on the station and just hope that they had a caff there or something. And then the train would go, woo, woo, to let us all know that they loaded all the scenery onto the train. And we all get aboard, get into our bunks, etc., etc., and then travel through the night until we get to the next town where, it's Tuesday, this must be Cleveland, and get out and do it again. And it was wonderful.
Was there a greater contrast with that when you went behind the Iron Curtain, for example? You went to Moscow.
It was Leningrad, actually, and that was in 1961. It was incredibly exciting. It was very good for you. I lost a stone because there was simply no food. And it was such an experience because they weren't going to warm to us necessarily. And slowly, over the time of our being there, the crowds at the stage door got larger and larger, and eventually we conquered Russia. This was a triumph for Dame Ninette de Valois because Russia was considered to be the home of ballet.
Sometimes ballet is seen as a very elitist art form only for the rich. But I think you've performed in front of some mass audiences. I think in Brazil you were in a football stadium, weren't you?
The football stadium in Rio de Janeiro. Vast. I was not in the first ballet, so I went out front deliberately to absorb the atmosphere. And I was astonished. The vast majority of these people had never seen ballet in their lives. And they became so perceptive in such a short space of time.
When you look back to remembering that audition you had with Ninette de Valois all those years ago, did you think then that you'd still be doing it in 50 years' time?
It's 55.
Well,
I've been privileged, really, to be performing for more than half the time that modern ballet has existed. No, I had no idea I would last this long. I thought I'd be lucky to last to 30.
Elegance. David drew on his remarkable 55-year career with London's Royal Ballet. You can see photos of David with me on our website at bbcworldservice.com/outlook. And whilst you're there, you can check out our montage of photos of you with your best listeners. It's looking pretty good. Or you can click through to become our friend on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to the Outlook podcast. The address again, bbcworldservice.com/outlook. But that's all from today's programme. I'm Matthew Bannister. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow with another edition of Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'll see you then.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of Carle Foundation's Echo Center, on the web at ratioarchitects.com. Ratio Architects encourages you to join them in supporting WILL.
Today's weather, rain and wind, heavy rain at times, the high 43, east winds at 20 to 25 miles an hour, gusts to around 35. Rainy and windy tonight, heavy rain at times in the evening, near steady temperatures around 40 with east winds at 20 to 25, gusts to around 40. Christmas Day, cloudy, still windy with a chance of rain or snow in the morning and a high of 38 degrees, gusts to around 35 miles an hour. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.